grandson's wedding in Arkansas was good. A wonderful time with family, and I appreciate your prayers for our safe travel. And we know of several that are traveling today from this group, and there's four or five that are sick today, colds and coughs and a combination of things. So we have some who are traveling and some who are under the weather. We hope that they do better. It's good to see Mark and especially Wendy here. Wendy is in our prayers for medical information and treatments. And those who celebrated a son's graduation from college, back from Sacramento, that was a big board that they had them on. That was nice to be able to see. Andrew walking across the stage on this huge board in the event center there where the Sacramento State had the graduation. You didn't have to worry about seeing and having close-up view there for sure. But congratulations there. Turn to 1 Corinthians 7. We need to finish the chapter only because it involves some situations that never come up in a congregation. I began my 43rd year of ministry last Thursday, and until you study 1 Corinthians 7, many of these issues never come up. There's no need to talk about them, and yet it is a subject that does have merit. If you are not married, or if you are a widow or widower, or if you are wishing you were married but never found the right person and are still single, these verses address you. And only because it's in Scripture is it worth our time, but it does address circumstances that can relate to all of us. We're in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 25, looking at those who are referred to as virgins, but the text is really suggesting those who are single. Those who are single. He said, "I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the grace, by the Lord's mercy, is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think it is good for you to remain as you are." Remain single. Remember, this chapter is Paul addressing questions that the Christians at Corinth had. And they had been led to believe and were asking the question, does a Christian need to be celibate? Suggesting that sex was unclean, was not appropriate for some reason, even if you're married. And he addresses that in the early sections of the chapter. But now he goes to those who are not married. And he says, "Are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this." Paul was not married. He saw it as a blessing. He saw it as a gift from God, which enabled him to spend more of his time serving the Lord. But he acknowledged in earlier verses that when we are in a married relationship and when we have family, that family needs our time. We could also say they deserve our time. And so if you have family responsibilities, you must be responsible in those areas. If you're not married, if you don't have a family per se, then you're free to come and go as you wish. You're free to do things on a schedule that others could not do those things. And so he's simply acknowledging that there are several in churches today, I think it's relevant, there are several in churches today who are trying to decide, what does God feel about me? What should I be aiming for or striving toward in my relationships? And he's basically saying, either is okay. If you are, it's okay. If you're not, it's okay. But understand that if you're in a relationship, a family relationship, a married relationship, it involves responsibilities that the other would not have. If you were single, widow, or widower. There are many church widows in our congregations. You heard that term? It's women who are here without their husbands. You're a member of a congregation and they won't come with you. And it's as if you're a church widow. I've heard that a widower, in fact, is possible. But the reality is, in this case, it's simply describing a situation that would be looked down upon, and he doesn't want you to feel as if you should be looked down upon. It's not a decision by God. It's not a command from God. It's a choice, but the choice does have ramifications as it speaks to the responsibility or the time element. This isn't the same thing, but it's similar. When we drove home September several years ago, three of our children were at Harding the same year. And we drove home and we realized our whole life is different. We had car trouble going from Florida into Georgia. We had to leave a car there and tow it home on the way home. And I bumped into a basketball goal that had been up at the end of our driveway for a number of years. And I just touched it barely when we were backing in to get the trailer with the car into the driveway off the sidewalk. And I just barely touched that basketball goal. We had put concrete in the pole as well as the base. And it went, it just went to the ground. And it didn't upset us or startle us, but it seemed to be a sign to us. We no longer have children at home. And that basketball goal is not needed the way it was when we had three children at home. It was as if you're without children now. And we've always remembered that. It just seems to be a lesson, if you will. But he's addressing real life situations. Look at verse 32. I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. Now, he's certainly speaking to the male and the female in this regard. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. And his interests are divided. And there's no refuting that. But I would argue, and it's something that the discipling ministry was good at several years ago, to place guilt upon those who were part of that fellowship, they would set apart mandated methodology. For instance, you can't play tennis with someone unless you're planning to invite him to your Bible talk. And if you've invited him to our Bible study, in other words, and he's not interested, you can no longer have anything to do with him. And it was a mandated to be very conscious of your time and who you're trying to convert, and don't let other relationships or other circumstances get in the way. And that's not what this verse is saying, but it is acknowledging that being married involves other responsibilities. I am a Christian husband as well as a Christian man and a Christian grandfather and a Christian uncle and a Christian brother in Christ. I say all of that to say that my life and your life as a Christian isn't divided into secular and spiritual. And that's the mistake that we would begin to make if we overinterpret some of what's being said. I lost it, and I think I may have shared it once here, but I'm not remembering. I lost it when we went to China, when we stored most of my library and books, but I had a sermon, and part of that sermon was a writing of a Christian woman, and it was called Rapture. And it wasn't suggested that there is a rapture. I don't believe the Bible teaches us that. But it was revealing her concern at what she would be doing when the Lord comes. And the short little statement was with the idea that I hope that I'm praying. I hope that I'm reading the Bible. I hope that I'm in a Bible study or worship. And there's nothing wrong with being in those circumstances when the Lord comes. But it's propagating a false narrative to suggest that being a wife, washing the clothes of my family, or doing the dishes after we've had a great meal as a family is somehow demeaning. It's not worthy of my time. I want to be doing that which is worthy of my time when the Lord comes. And her expression in that short statement, a poem, suggested that normal things aren't worthy. But if we're a Christian, we're doing Christian things in whatever we do. We do it as a Christian. And we don't divide the secular life, that's away from church activity, if you will, and attaching it to secular things, which is just work, things I do at home, as if they aren't what they ought to be. We built a new building in South Florida several years ago, and we wanted to schedule some things to encourage participation the first few weeks that we were there. We had a fellowship very quickly in the new building. We wanted to encourage a few other things. And yet in doing that, we came to realize that the worst thing a congregation can do is to overschedule things for their members to attend that take away from family life. You don't need to be here every night of the week. You don't need to be involved in something related to a church function to the extent that it hurts your family life. You have responsibilities there. They have needs to be there. And the church calendar reflects an awareness of a family's needs and the life that a family leads. And I have found myself over the years of saying, this is optional. This is something for those who are able to be here. I don't consider it a mandated command of God. This is an optional thing. Not Sunday morning worship, not communing weekly and where we do that, but there are some things that are optional to your schedule, and if you're able to, we sure love to have you be here. And I think that's true. I think it's being realistic to the congregational life and schedule and family circumstances. But he's suggesting, and he tells us, that our concerns for the Lord's work and our responsibility is part of the consideration when he's answering that question. His interests are divided is a truism. A husband and a Christian husband, if you will. An unmarried woman is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. I'm in verse 34a. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. Now, he's not segregating secular and Christian. I don't think he's doing that. He's just simply saying that we have different responsibilities. And we have to acknowledge that. Verse 35, I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you might live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. The goal is to serve the Lord. And how and when we do it is affected if we take on responsibilities of life, even marriage, children, other things, certainly work. Verse 39, a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. In my judgment, she is happier if she stays as she is, and I think that I too have the Spirit of God. It's advice that I believe is God-given. He's speaking as an apostle, but less so as just someone inspired by the blessing of God. Don't be unequally yoked, another way of saying this same thing. I personally do not believe that is telling us that you cannot marry if your husband or wife dies, that you must marry a Christian. To be unequally yoked means that you're putting yourself in a circumstance to where you don't have a say in the matter. That you are put in a circumstance to where you cannot go there. You cannot do those things. You cannot be a part of that congregation any longer, if you will. There's too many circumstances in Scripture that acknowledge that a Christian is married to a non-Christian. And it doesn't suggest that you should leave that relationship. It's simply saying that don't put yourself in a relationship where you can't serve the Lord. And if that relationship would cease, would cause that to cease, then you need to consider that. Lou Holtz made a statement in the realm of football a number of years ago. He says, most of what happens when you throw a forward pass is negative. One, it's incomplete. Two, it's intercepted. Three, it's caught for a negative. And four, it's caught with a positive. Three out of four are negatives. Now, he didn't say what I'm about to say, but I always remember his comment there. And, of course, now the passing game is so much a part of football. When a Christian marries another person, several things are possible. One, that person will be an encouragement to them in their Christian walk. And that's the desire. It should be the want of the individual getting married. And it should be something that's very pertinent to their decision-making process. The other thing that can happen is they will show a limited interest so that you will marry them, and then they have no interest. And that happens. The other thing that can happen is they have no interest at all, beginning or end. And what's that going to do to you? Will you come less because of that relationship? Will you be less involved because of that marriage relationship that you're about to enter into? And then the fourth thing is you will fall away completely. Oh, come on, just one weekend. And that one weekend becomes just once a month. Come on, let's do this on Sunday, once a month. And then once a quarter or twice a quarter or whatever. You'll be less involved. You'll be unfaithful totally. Or you'll be just as fervent and be in a position to perhaps without words win that spouse. And that's what 1 Peter 3 talks about, without words. And we looked at that 2 weeks ago briefly. All of that enters in to what chapter 7 is seeking to discuss. Are you going to be the same person you are now in your fervency to the Lord? And marriage may have nothing to do with it. Other things may come into your life, but they can have the same effect. Less activity, less interest, lose all interest altogether. And
And then the other translations
that I looked at, the ESV, ASB, 8 King James Version, right, you said only in the Lord. And so I'm just questioning what your explanation was, which is different than what the scriptures are. And that's why Paul is talking to the Corinthians in a specific situation. And it's hard for me to understand why is this different here when other passages talk about being unequally yoked, which is a different concept. Or 1 Peter 3 talking about don't leave your unbelieving husband. You are the best hope to convert him, essentially. It's difficult. Yeah.
And if they are to be married, then the command seems to mean that they should marry only in the Lord. And of course not be unequally yoked, because if they the intended
right.
not in the Lord, they would definitely be unequally yoked.
Right. Yeah. I don't know that I understand fully what verse 39 is saying. I know of too many situations to where a Christian man married a non-believing woman, but within months she became a Christian, became one of the greatest Christian teachers. She was an elder's wife. There's too many situations that it doesn't seem as if it's that specific, but yet it does suggest that the thinking needs to be that you marry a Christian. I don't know. Richard?
Three things.
Yep.
One, the principle in the Old Testament for the Israelites to keep themselves pure was to not marry outside
Judaism.
So I think that principle applies here. I also think that in the example you gave about a Christian man marrying a Christian woman, Christian women are much more likely to become Christians than Christian men.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Also, in this passage, before and close to this passage when he's still talking about this, he's saying it's not a command of the Lord. He's saying, I have authority here, and I'm saying don't do it. And I do agree with Anne, and she says, must. I don't have the Greek in front of me, so I can't.
Yeah, I don't either.
But I'm thinking that he's saying
Yeah.
Am I going to condemn someone if they do it? I don't think I can do that. But I would strongly caution them. You're setting yourself up for problems either in a relationship or losing your faith.
Yeah, is it good advice? Of course. Is it a mandate? I'm not sure. I'm not certain.
Well, he does reinforce it in 2 Corinthians 6:14. Do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light and darkness?
That's unequally yoked. That principle of unequally yoked. Yeah. Talking to the same people. Paul is addressing questions that were raised by Corinth, and he's trying to do it so as to keep the focus on God. And whatever we need to do to keep the focus on God has to be what these verses are saying. The mandate, I have to back away and say I'm not understanding that fully, because there's too many other verses that suggest that they should stay together. And you have the opportunity to convert this person. But certainly there's no question that the mandate of the whole chapter is set your affections to where your work for the Lord and your relationship to God is not harmed or hampered. That's a mandate we understand. Richard? Yeah.
So now from that point on, I'm thinking she shouldn't be unequal.
Well, yeah, she's free to remarry. It's the will of Romans 7 deals with the same thing.
What I'm saying is, yes, she can remarry, but it has to be someone in the door. So what I'm asking is, I'm not sure how you're differentiating the unequally yoked from this.
Well, there's other passages that talk about being unequally yoked. And
they're already married. They haven't died.
Yeah. And the reality is, don't let it affect your relationship with the God, with the Lord. Taking the metaphor of the yoke and having control over you, whereas don't have someone with control over you as far as your spiritual life, is the principle in other passages. Let's go to a subject in 1 Corinthians 9. It doesn't need a lot of attention, I don't think. But there are times when Paul was asked to defend his ministry. And Corinth and Thessalonian churches, Christians in Corinth and Thessalonica, he was called upon to justify himself, to answer, if you will, the charges against him. And he's talking about his rights in the early verses. Verse 5, do we have the right to take a believing wife along with us, as do the other apostles and the Lord's brother and Cephas? Or is it only I and Barnabas who must work for a living? Now, basically, he's saying, I'm defending my ministry and I've chosen not to be married, but do I have the right to be married? And he makes a list, including Peter, by the way. Peter was married, and millions of religious people today want to ignore that fact. But do I have the right, or do I, like Barnabas, need to remain unmarried, if you will? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Verse 7. Who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its grapes? Who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk? Do I say this merely from a human point of view? Doesn't the law say the same thing? For it is written in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. Is it about oxen that God is concerned? Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? So he's saying, in principle, a person is worthy of being paid who does the work. Now, I'm not about to ask for a raise, and no one is questioning whether a minister should be paid as he's ministering with a congregation. But the issue came up with Paul, and it does give us the opportunity to hear him speak on the subject. Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? Yes, this was written for us, because when the plowman plows and the thresher threshes, they ought to do so in the hope of sharing in the harvest. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? So he was defending ministry, but he was also acknowledging attacks against him. And what Paul is saying is, I'm not about to ask for payment, but I have the right to. I choose to work as a tent maker. I don't receive payment, but I have the right to. And he uses examples from everyday life and from the law of Moses to present that premise. Do we not use this right? On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Don't you know that those who work in the temple get their food from the temple? And those who serve at the altar share in what is offered at the altar? In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. But I have not used any of these rights. So he states his particular decision, but lays it alongside a principle that he wants them to understand. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. The latter stages of verse 16. My dad was an elder for 31 years. I was a member of that congregation for about 10, finishing high school and then coming back after college for a short time. At a congregational meeting, one of the members said, I want to know what we pay our minister. It was not out there for public consumption. Personally, I think that's the way it ought to be, and I'll tell you why. And my dad says, you have every right to know what we pay the minister, and I will share it with you in private. He said, I think we should all know right now. He says, what do you make? And the person says, okay, I'll see you in private. My dad made his point, don't you think? Do any of us want to share what we make to most people? It's a private matter, and it's understood that way. But a budget and the spending of the Lord's money needs to be known by people. If they want it, they should be told whatever they need to know. But some things can be kept private. And that was his way of making a necessary point to that individual. This person, a number of years later, we were at his house, and he said, I have a problem of speaking my mind. And I says, yes, and sometimes those who speak their mind need to be careful what they think. And he looked at me and he smiled and says, you're right. You're right. There are times when we get into a huff, an old Southern expression, about our rights to know something. And sometimes we don't have the right to know everything, and sometimes in private is the best way to receive it. And that's just a truism that runs true to the place of work. It is related to the place of worship. And Paul was defending the right, but he's choosing not to take advantage of that situation because he knew the concerns that apparently some would have. And he was unable. Evan? Yeah, because we have some watching. Evan's comment is we have elders, we trust them, and who's going to oversee the ones who are overseeing the elders if some people put themselves in that position? The reason I choose to deal with this in class today because the principles that can come up is part of the Sunday morning sermon of handling conflict. And the reality is that there are good ways of doing it, and there's some difficult ways to handle some situations in a congregation. And Paul defended the right, but he didn't choose to go down that path. I don't know many people like Paul who could do full-time ministry and support themselves. I do know of circumstances to where there's concern and money's an issue and things have to be done. Sometimes ministers let go because circumstances have occurred and they can no longer afford the person they have. There's all manner of things that could come up in regards to this situation. But he's discussing his right, and then he's not choosing to participate in that circumstance. Comments or questions? I don't plan to spend a lot of time on it. Paul doesn't. But it is a question that he addresses in this letter. What then is my reward? Verse 18, just this, that in preaching the gospel I may offer it free of charge and so not make use of my rights in preaching it. And that's his summation as it speaks to his choice, but he's made the argument for the other. I'm going to save the latter part of verse of chapter 9 for next week because I want to have more time to develop it and I want the larger audience to hear it. I think it's important for our evangelism efforts, if you will. I'm through, unless you have questions. Yes. No.
It's more like your children are not, you know, there are unkind words people use to describe, you know, children of unwed people or whatever. That it basically means your children aren't legitimate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
we
looked at it briefly 2 weeks ago. The word sanctified is hagios, and the word holy is hagios. And he uses two words to say the same thing. And a marriage is sanctified. It's set apart by God. Now, that matches what we saw in Hebrews 13 when it says honor marriage. My marriage is set apart by God, and He needs others to honor the fact that she is mine and I am hers, and to not to impinge upon the relationships that others have. If we honor marriage, we honor the fact that that couple is married. And I'm not involved in trying to win them over or seduce them or whatever might be involved. So the word sanctified means they're set apart. When it says the children are holy, it's a little different, but it's the exact same word. And I think what it's telling us is, well, you tell me, we associate it with the age of accountability. When is a child unholy to God? When they reach an age to willfully sin and do it against God's will knowingly. And we don't have an age of accountability specified for us. We know at some point a child is old enough to be held responsible for their actions by parents. But that's younger than a child is old enough to sin and be condemned by God. That's very different. It's very different. And so I think when he talks about the holy children in this sanctified marriage, he's talking about a relationship they have with God because of being a child and being in a Christian home, even though one of the parents is not a believer. And it's a relationship that you need to consider. Divorce is part of our congregation's life. It's been that way for many decades now. And it affects children drastically. I know 40-year-old people who still think that they're the reason their parents divorced when they were 13 years old. They hold a responsibility to themselves as if it's me, I caused that. And that would never be the case. But children are affected. And I think that verse is wanting us to realize the relationship God has with that child and children as a whole and what you're going to do, the decision you're going to make as you would consider leaving an unbelieving spouse. The words are different but the same, if you will. Sanctified, hagios, holy, hagios. One... Darius, and then here. Yeah. Honoring marriage honors the relationship of two people, and it certainly is extended when children are brought into that family, of honoring the relationships that are incumbent because of those births.
My mom split us apart, Mm-hmm. You know, I was supposed to be married at a church in Petaluma. They just, you know,
sure,
grabbed me and said, you're not getting married. So I thank God that I didn't get married because the guy was, like, not a good guy. Yeah. And
good that you can see that. There you go. Married to God, best man in the world, was just said. What a great way to finish. Paul is giving us the best advice that he can give us from his relationship with God as an apostle. He acknowledges that some of it isn't things taught by Jesus. It wasn't matters that were spoken on, if you will. But he has the right, guided by the Spirit, to give these directions. I'm not afraid to say that I'm just not sure the extent of what that means. I would rather be candid about it and keep being open, keep trying to figure it out. I encourage you to do the same thing. Evan, you have last comment? Well, it certainly can, but it's discussing the relationship that you would be in. Yeah. It's a principle. Yeah, it's a principle. Thank you for your interest. There are some traveling, so keep them in your prayers. There are some sick. Keep them in your prayers as you are made aware of that.